We are starting a new series today, one that's going to take us partway into the summer. It is called Reading the Metaphors. And I want to talk about how the Bible uses a lot of figurative language. It uses symbols, it uses metaphors to give a lot of its meaning. And we need to learn how to read them and live them if we're going to be people of the book. That is two problems that we have to overcome when we deal with metaphors, particularly biblical metaphors. One is that we all have been taught in school and in a lot of other places that metaphors aren't always real good. In fact, logic is meant to be lifted up. And I remember getting in trouble for a paper one time because I used a metaphor for something, and they said, well, don't use the metaphor, just say what you want to say, right? And so we've been taught since the Enlightenment that metaphors aren't as strong as logic. And I'm going to show you how it's not true, that your mind works on metaphors, how your brain actually works. But the other part of the problem, so part of the problem is we've got to learn how to use metaphor. But part of the other part of the problem is that when the Bible uses metaphors, it uses old metaphors. Okay? Metaphors work if they're based on common human experience and common human language. And the problem is, we don't share the same life that people 2,000 or 3,000 years ago do. So when they use a metaphor, like a shepherd, I can try to imagine what a shepherd is, but I have to do the work of imagining, because I've never really seen a shepherd. Not a first century shepherd. So let's dive in with a modern metaphor to try to help us understand just how fundamental metaphor is to our thinking. In fact, there's a metaphor, there's a paradigm that everybody in here uses that you never agreed to, and I doubt you were ever taught this, actually, out loud, more specifically. But I bet everybody in here will understand exactly what I'm talking about, and you've never even thought of it as a metaphor before. Are you ready? Everybody in here would agree that up is good and down is bad. When you think of good and you think of bad, up is good and down is bad. No matter what you're talking about, you think of good being up and down being bad. You never think down is good. Things are going down. That's bad. Okay? Things are going up. Looks good. Happy is up. Down. Watch how wide-ranging this is. Happy is down. Happy is up and down is sad. You'll say, I have high spirits. Oh, you boosted my spirits. You gave me a real lift. Or, I'm feeling down. Really feel low today. Feeling into a depression. My spirit's sent. Right? Happy up, sad down. What about this one? Conscious is up and unconscious is down. How many of you woke up today? You don't get down. That's a dance. That's not good. You get up in the morning. But what do you do to sleep? You fall asleep. Okay, you go under hypnosis. You sink into a coma. Okay? Healthy is up, sickness is down. I'm in peak physical condition. I'm in top shape. Or, I fell ill. I came down with the flu. You never come up with the flu. You come down with the flu. My health is declining. You drop dead. Dead bad. So it's down. Okay? Here's another one. Up is control, down is subjugation. I have control over the situation. I'm on top of things. I'm in high command. But they are under my control. He fell from power. I'm the low man on the totem pole. Up is the future. Down is the past. What events are upcoming? What's ahead? What's up? Oh, there was a fight yesterday. Oh, what went down? Right? Down's back, up is forward. Here's some more. High status is up and low status is down. He's in a lofty position. He rose to the top. She's climbing the corporate ladder. We love upward mobility. We don't like falling from someone's good graces. We don't want to be lower class. Up is good, down is bad. Things are looking up. We've hit a peak. That's high quality work. But it's been downhill ever since. Right? The results are coming back to earth. I've come up with some good ideas, but I voted down some bad ones. You want to see how widespread this is? Here's some other ones. Virtue is up. Depravity is down. She has high standards. She is an upright and upstanding citizen. But you don't want to be what? Underhanded. He wouldn't stoop to that. That behavior is below my standards. Why, you low down dirty. Everybody in here has used some of these phrases. And you've never come up with the flu. You always come down with the flu. Everybody in here agrees. Up is good, down is bad. And if you ever orient it the other way, it sounds weird. We all agree to that. That is something we meant to. That's like our mental map. Up, good, down, bad. Were you ever taught that? Did you ever make a contract with somebody? And did anybody ever pull you aside and say, listen, Jordan, whenever you talk about good, it has to be up. And yet, symbolically, we all think of good, up, down, bad. Notice, it's not just a metaphor at that point. It's fundamental to how we think. In fact, I got this and started thinking about this from a book I had to read in grad school called Metaphors We Live By. And their point was, these metaphors are so deep, they're just fundamental to our thinking. Like, we don't even think about it as a metaphor anymore. That's how metaphors can work. They can be so fundamental that they change our thinking. That, I think, is what we're supposed to do with biblical metaphors. The Bible metaphors are supposed to sink into us so much that we start to think of God as our shepherd. And we start to pick up on some of these metaphors as part of who we are, like up and down. But to do that, you've got to do a little work. Because their metaphors are different than ours. They walked everywhere. They didn't know what a car was. Okay? They had to use salt to keep things good because they didn't have refrigeration. They didn't have light. They didn't have heat. And so to read the metaphors of the Bible, you got to do the work of entering the world of the Bible to see what the metaphor was. And then, when you do that, it helps make sense of the metaphor. In the Bible, there's any number of these metaphors. And in fact, I'm going to show you that if you pick up on some of these major metaphors, you can tell the whole story of the Bible using some of these metaphors. So that's this sermon series. That's a longer intro. So what we're going to do for a few weeks here, we're going to go into the summer looking at metaphors and trying to pick apart what do they mean and how do we read them, because that's how a lot of the Bible is written. And today we're going to kick off with a metaphor that I've been thinking a lot about, and maybe some of you have too, the idea of the heavens. Ever since seeing this eclipse, it's made me start to think about the heavens a lot more. Now, confession time. I was one of those people that did not care about the eclipse. Was anybody else like that? Like, it was on the news, and everybody was like, oh, talking about it. And then somebody from our church said, we should do a bus trip. And I was like, wow. And honestly, I did not want to go. But so it became a work trip for me. It was not like a fun bus trip. It was a work trip. I got to go and be with people and stuff. It's fine. But I was blown away by the eclipse. Was anybody else? It was so much cooler than I thought it was going to be. And those of us who were at Camp Lambeck, we were on the lake, and it was cloudy, and then all of a sudden, the clouds moved, and the totality happened, and it went, like, eerily dark, and you could stare at the sun all of a sudden, and it was tremendous. It was one of the most amazing experiences of my life, really. But I was thinking about, how would you have experienced that if you lived in the first century? Right? If you read Bible Times, that wasn't on the news. You know what I mean? That wasn't on the news. You didn't know about it. They didn't have glasses for watching that stuff, right? I mean, I not only knew that it was coming, I had glasses so I could see the moon getting in front. They didn't have that. What would it have been like in the first century? Boom, dark. Would that have freaked you out, anybody? Right? The world stops for 3 minutes and you're like, what is going on? Made me start to think about, well, how did ancient people think about the skies? So, what did they think about? Well, they did not know They didn't know the world was round. They didn't know these things were light years. Imagine how much science you have to know to understand the concept of a light year. Right? They got to understand how light beams work and that you can measure it and that it travels a year. I mean, they had no idea what you know scientifically about the sun and the moon and the stars. Most people in those days believed that the earth was flat. It was a disk, and there was sort of a dome over it. And the dome kept some kind of waters back, because they looked at the sky and said, those look like waters. And they assumed that the gods were up there, and that hanging from this dome were the stars and the sun and the moon. And so the sun had sort of its course that it was supposed to take, and the moon had sort of its course, and the sun, the stars were up there, and they assumed that if something weird happened up there, it was the gods that were moving things. So they would have assumed that the gods were saying to you, oh, I want to see that, it must happen. After all, some of those things up there look like pictures. Right? That one looks like a cup. Okay? That one looks like a dragon. What does that mean? And what does it mean when something falls from the sky, when something shoots across the sky? You can see how they were trying to think about these things. Now, I want to also say, we sometimes look back at ancient people and think they're stupid. They're not stupid either. There were certain things that they could totally figure out and be in tune with. For instance, when the big yellow one's out, it's warm. They knew that. The big one, a yellow one comes out, it's brighter. The moon seemed to change its shape on a cycle, on a period, and somehow that seemed to fit with what was happening in a woman's body, about that same kind of timing. There was this sense that all these things sort of fit together somehow. They also knew that they could get sunburned, they could get sunstroke. If you work too hard out under the big yellow one, that's a problem, right? So they understood that. They understood there were seasons when you get more of that big yellow one, and that's when our plants would grow. Sometimes you couldn't see it as much. So they understood some of, they couldn't understand maybe the science of it, but they had some of the flow of that. So let's think about Israel in specifics now. How does the Bible, the people of the Bible understand? Well, first of all, they didn't think that those things in the sky were gods. That was what some people thought. And they didn't think there were lots of gods up there moving it around. They believed in one God. And so they believed in the God, the one God put those things there. And so they didn't worship those things. They worshiped the one God. Here's the language of Genesis chapter 1. So right from the beginning of this book. And God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night and the stars. And God set them in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth, to rule over the day and over the night, and to separate the light from darkness. And God saw that it was good. So the Israelites did not worship these things. They were made by God. And you didn't worship what was made by God. You worshiped God. Part of the purpose of these things was functional. They understood. They gave light. They gave a rhythm to life. But also they began to understand that somehow, like all of creation, these beings in the sky, these heavens, did something about the glory of God. Psalm 19 says, the heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day they put forth speech. Night after night they reveal knowledge. They have no speech. They use no words. No sound is heard from them. Yet their voices go out in all the earth, their words the ends of the earth. In the heavens, God has pitched a tent for the sun. It is like a bridegroom coming out of his chamber, like a champion rejoicing to run his course. It rises at one end of the heavens and makes its circuit to the other. Nothing is deprived of its warmth. The idea was, to begin, they don't know that we are spinning. What do they assume? The sun has a course, like a runner. It runs across the sky. And God put it that way. What's its purpose? Part of its purpose is to declare the goodness of God, the glory of God. That even though these things in the sky, they don't have words, they don't make sounds, they are constantly declaring the goodness of God. The sun is referenced in the Bible 150 times, most often as a source of light. The psalm I just read talked about it running its race every day. But Jewish time was actually based on the moon. Psalm 104:19 says, "He made the moon to mark the seasons, the sun to know its time for setting." So Jewish thought was actually based on the moon, not on the sun. Here's a couple of examples. Their months weren't based on the sun the way ours is. Their months were based on the moon. This is why Easter moves. Does that ever bother anybody? Like, Thanksgiving is the Thursday. Why is Easter always moving around? It's because it has to do with the moon. It's a new moon. Okay? Because it goes with Passover. Passover is Jewish and it moves based on the moon. Their day was also different. I don't know if you've ever thought of this, but the day started at sunset. Okay? Genesis, if I had read another line from that Genesis verse, it would have said, "And it was evening, and it was morning the first day." First day starts at evening. It starts with the moon, not the sun. Their view was that the moon is the cycle of the moon is what actually drives the calendar and drives the rhythm, not the sun. Stars are referenced some 70 times in the Bible, mainly as a show of numbers. In other words, they would go outside and start trying to count stars. Have you ever tried to do this? Try to count stars and see how far you get. Okay? There's just so many of them. They're countless. This is one of the major metaphors of stars in the Bible. In fact, in Genesis 15, God promises Abraham, "And he brought him outside and said, 'Look toward heaven and number the stars, if you are able to number them.' Then he said to him, 'So shall your offspring be.'" And that's the promise of Abraham. Two stars, that's your offspring. Now, if the heavens are a good thing because God made them and guides them, then a change in the heavens can also be a sign of judgment. So the prophets used to talk about how someday God's going to judge this world. If God is so good and the heavens declare his glory, well, then someday a glorious and perfect God is going to have to come and judge how evil this world is. And one of the signs of that may be the darkness. Joel 2:31 says, "The sun will be turned to darkness and the moon to blood before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord." I wonder if Joel had been through an eclipse. Okay, I wonder if he had seen something like what we all saw. And said, that's what it's going to be like. And that was part of what God led him to say. Hey, this is what it's going to be like. It's not going to be all good. Israel used to talk as if God's judgment was going to be great because God was going to judge their enemies. And the prophets are constantly saying, yeah, but it's not as good as you think it is. Because when God comes to judge, he's going to judge everybody. And none of us are worthy. So I hope you can see these metaphors and how they're thinking. We've got to put ourselves in their head a little bit to start understanding how these images are used. But what's amazing is once you start to do that, you start to then look at how some of these images play out in the stories of the Bible, you can actually start to tell the entire story of the Bible using these images. Okay, so I'm going to try to do that right now. I'm going to use the heavens to tell you the entire story of the Bible. Now, clearly, there's a lot of stuff I'm going to leave out, right? This is a big picture overview, 3 minutes of what the Bible says based on the heavens. But watch how this image plays out in the story. We begin with creation. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. He made it. He said it was good. The stars and the planets were beautiful. But it didn't take long before something wasn't good. The stars, the heavens were still beautiful, but humanity had fallen from where it should be. And those who looked up at the sun and the moon weren't the people God intended them to be. But God would intervene. He called out a man named Abraham and told him that his offspring would be as numerous as the stars. He would give them a land that would bless them. The process would not be easy, though. They would go through slavery in Egypt. Then when they finally got back to their land, they would have to fight for that land. There's this great story in Joshua 10 where they're trying to fight with another nation, another people for that land, and they're starting to win, but the day is running out, and so Joshua commands that the sun stay still for a whole 24-hour period. Night didn't come. It just stayed daylight. So God used the sun to bless the people, and they won the battle. They would win the land, and eventually they would have kings. The greatest of these kings probably is King David, who wrote the Psalms and talked a lot. One of his themes is that the heavens declare the glory of God. Later on, prophets would come to critique the kings and to critique the people. And what would they say? They would say that God has to bring justice to this world, that the glory of God and the righteousness of God demanded a sense of justice, and that someday the sun would go out and there would be judgment. But at the same time, there were promises that light would come again. Malachi 4:2 said, promises that the sun will come back. The phrase he uses is the sun of righteousness, S-U-N. The sun of righteousness will rise, bringing healing in his wings. We believe that the promises of the Old Testament are actually fulfilled in Jesus. And so it's no wonder when Jesus is born, what marks his birth? A star. A star. The heavens have to declare what's going on. So a light guides those who would worship him to find him lying in a manger. Of course, the surprise is that Jesus doesn't come to rule the way we might expect him. What does he come to do? Die on the cross. And what happens while he's on the cross?
It goes dark.
The sun goes out. And all those who saw the sun, well, we don't know if it's an eclipse, if it's just a really cloudy day, but all those people who had read the scriptures had to have been thinking as it went dark about Joel, about Amos, about Isaiah, who said God would judge in darkness this world. But here's the amazing part is God is doing that judging, but he's also hanging on the cross in the darkness. And then there's this amazing verse at the end of Revelation. Revelation 21 says, Revelation 21, 22 and 23 says, I saw no temple in the city, for its temple is the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb. So the temple is a place that we all go to meet with God. We won't need it anymore, because God is the temple. And then it goes on to say, and the city has no need of sun or moon to shine on, for the glory of God gives the light, and its lamp is the Lamb. In other words, how does the Bible end? This is the second to last chapter of the Bible. It says, all our need for the sun and the moon that we've all felt our whole lives, we won't need it anymore, because God will be our light. Because Jesus, the Son, will come. See, there's the whole Bible, real quick, using that metaphor, the sun and the moon and the stars. I hope as we unpack more metaphors, it'll help you learn how to read metaphors, help you read your Bible more fully. And I hope some of these metaphors, like up and down, might be part of who we are. What if next time you go outside and you stare up at the stars? You see the sun peek through the clouds. Parts of this story come to your mind. Or maybe consider your clothes, that when you look up at the heavens, you might think what Psalm 8 says. When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars, which you have set in place, what is mankind that you are mindful of them? Human beings that you care for. Part of what we're meant to do is look up at these amazing things. Sun, moon, stars, eclipses, clouds, rainbows, thunder, lightning, and we're supposed to say, what am I? Who am I that you would love me